Blog Talk Radio.
Another episode we have here on this great Sunday morning of Suspense Radio One-on-One and partnered with PartnersInCrimeTours.com, so you check them out. I'm your host, John Rao. Today's guest, we are having the writing team of Bill Walker and Brian Anthony, and their book is called Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number One, and Suspense Radio One-on-One, 30 minutes, starts right now. Welcome back here to Suspense Radio One-on-One, wherever you're listening, however you're listening, whenever you're listening. We appreciate you being here with us. So let's jump right in here, like I said, to the writing team of Bill Walker and Brian Anthony. The book is called Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number One. And Brian and Bill, thank you so much for coming on today. How are you guys doing?
We're doing fine. How are you?
Hi, John. Thanks for having us on.
No problem. I'm doing very well. And it always intrigues me when I see a book, of course, by a, you know, by a major historical figure, you know, of course, like an Abe Lincoln, you know, they brought out the vampire thing and the things like that. But give us a little bit behind the book, you know, the conception of it, you know, the writing team together, how all this kind of works in tandem with each other.
Well, as it says in the back of the book and in Brian's afterword, it started as a film project back at Emerson College in the 1970s. And it was sort of a one-joke film. What if we had Abe Lincoln pretending to be John Dillinger and going around robbing banks and things? And we shot it, and we didn't finish it because of various issues, and we put it aside, and, you know, 37 years later, we were talking about it, and that's when I got the idea, well, why don't we take it and turn it into a book? And it was off to the races at that point.
And so, Abe Lincoln number one. So the book is basically, it says on here, an alternate history. So I take it now that, of course, he did not become the president, but he has become, like you said, more of the John Dillinger kind of in that role.
Well, not exactly. It begins in the 1860s and with Lincoln's assassination, and through a voodoo curse, he is kept alive, but, you know, more or less sleeping in suspended animation, and he wakes up in the 1930s, in 1933, during FDR's administration, and Lincoln has a real sense of fate, that he woke up for a reason and there are things for him to do, so he goes to Washington. He actually meets with FDR, who does not believe it could possibly be Lincoln until he meets him and speaks with him. And Lincoln is ready to resume his job as president of the United States,
which FDR doesn't take too kindly to.
FDR didn't take too many things kindly, did he?
No, there are a lot of things he did not. But then it becomes a question of power and FDR, you would think that Lincoln would be greeted as, you know, the great man coming back to solve all our problems. But here he's thrown in the political arena again, And he's a threat to FDR and a threat to FDR's plans. And they lock horns. They have very different opinions of how the country should be governed. FDR understands that he is president and that Lincoln died almost 70 years before. And Lincoln said, I'm going to finish the job. I went to sleep. I was president. I'm waking up. I'm going to resume duties. And they do not hit it off too well. But it becomes a little more complex than that. FDR wants Lincoln to retire, which Lincoln is remiss to do. He feels he has work to do. He feels he woke up for a reason. And he ends up accidentally being involved in the death of an agent, and that is FDR and J. Edgar Hoover's reason, excuse, to consider him a hunted man. He escapes, and he eventually hooks up with John Dillinger.
Through another twist of fate.
So now, were you guys, history majors? Is that the thing? Was that something that you were very interested in, kind of, growing up, maybe going through college and things, that you were really enamored with, history and kind of how things worked like that?
Well, for me, history has always been, an interest, an abiding interest of mine. I didn't study it in school beyond, high school. I didn't major in it. In fact, Brian and I both majored in film production at Emerson College. But, we were, both of us, are extensively well-read, and Lincoln has always been an interest of ours, and it came about in a very organic matter that way. As far as writing the book, it was a really, really fun experience.
Yeah, Lincoln is one of those, of course, probably besides George Washington, I would have to say, the most famous president of the time because of, everything that he did. And was that one of the reasons, and then FDR was another one because, we brought him out of the, into the Depression, out of the Depression, the whole thing. So when you're looking back at all of that and you see, like the dynamic of him and how he was back in the 1800s and now waking up into this new world, how are you going to go ahead and kind of write that with him being, hey, you know what, there he is, and now it's all in the future, and the dynamic of things have now changed. I mean, now there's cars. He never had cars. How are you going to, how is that when you were looking at doing it to get that, his mindset correct?
Well, that was one of the hardest things to do in the book, which was to have him wake up in the 1930s and make sense of the world around him. What we tried to do is take what we knew about Lincoln through, his own writings and writings about him, and stay very true to his character. And everything that happens when he wakes up with FDR, with J. Edgar Hoover, with John Dillinger, down to the robberies, down to the gang members, down to the shootouts, are all very strictly true history. And we had to find how Abraham Lincoln would fit in, how we could weave him into it, what his reaction would be. It's really about fate. Lincoln was handed a fate he didn't deserve, as was John Dillinger. John Dillinger was actually respected by a lot of people that knew him personally. Even policemen said, he seems like a decent guy. But when Dillinger was very young, he stole a car. He went joyriding. He went to the police. He gave himself up and said, I did a stupid thing. Went in front of the judge, asked for mercy, and he got 10 years at hard labor. And that's when he became a hardened criminal. So it was a stupid thing that a kid did, but, it was his fate. It the consequences of it changed his and a lot of other lives. And that's why we feel with the Lincoln character, if he is fated to wake up, what would he do with that when there are trains, when there are airplanes, when there are movies? He actually goes to a movie and he sees a revival of The Birth of a Nation. He's sitting in a movie theater and sees a movie about him and how people are perceiving him 70 years after he died.
And now, I'm always fascinated about writing teams because, you always maybe have one person that maybe does some of the outline and kind of construction, where the other one is maybe putting, more of the pen to paper to kind of get it all together. How is the dynamic between the two of you, since this was, conceptually a movie, and then you decided to make it into a book? How is that transition working between the two of you working together?
Well, I think, you know, I took the lead on that initially and wrote the first draft. Since I've written narrative fiction, you know, over the last 20 years, and Brian was more of a nonfiction writer, screenwriter, as was I. And I took it and decided to, you know, come up with a story that would make it work. And it was a challenge that I was really up to in that respect. It was a lot of fun to sit there and say, what if? And that, in a sense, drives everything I write. What if this happened? What if that happened? What would the characters do? And it was really important to me that Lincoln remain how we all perceive him. And that was another challenge. How do you have Lincoln, as we all remember and perceive him, logically robbing banks and still remaining sympathetic? So that was the kind of the challenge that went into writing it. And once I had finished the first draft, I kicked it over to Brian. He read it. He started making suggestions. We started tweaking it, and it became very much a back-and-forth kind of effort at that point.
And so, Brian, when you got the first draft, you know, from Bill and you started looking at it, what was your initial reaction to it?
Well, we had talked about it at length, and if I recall, we actually began writing two versions. And my background is as a nonfiction writer. I've written biography, and I was doing it more along those lines, whereas Bill was doing it as a fictional novel. And I'd say within days, I knew his was the way to go. It was like, yep, go with it. That's way, you know, it just was working. And he gave it to me. I read it through. Immediately, things stood out. He laid all the track, and the plot felt right. And I think he did a remarkable job in making it believable. And believable is an odd word for alternate history with the president waking up 70 years in the future. But I think a lot of what makes it work is the reaction of people. Most people in the book do not believe Lincoln is Abraham Lincoln. They think it's a tall guy that looks like Lincoln that's robbing banks. They think it's some kind of a joke. People that meet him have trouble believing that it's Lincoln. And at some points, he more or less gives up. He goes, yeah, I look like Lincoln. He's not trying to convince anyone of anything at some times. So once Bill had done a draft of it, at least to me, it became obvious what worked, which was a lot of it, and what didn't work. And that's where I would jump in, I would change things, and he would say yes, 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 no. And then we hit a sticking point, and that would go back and forth. And usually it wasn't his decision or my decision, but we go back and forth so many times, the right decision just presented itself. So it was a different way of writing than I've ever approached it, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work. There were some days we didn't talk to each other when, you know, we just came to loggerheads and disagreed, but, you know, eventually it all worked out.
And again, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with the writing team of Brian Anthony and Bill Walker. Their book is called Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number One. You can go to LincolnPublicEnemy.com for a lot more information about the book and everything that is around the two authors. And so the other thing that you always kind of get when, you know, when you always have a writing team is you can kind of see each other's voice within, you know, the book. Is that the same thing that fans, you know, might notice, that they can kind of see, you know, the voice of each of you coming out of this?
I think, you know, it's a logical thing to think that would be the case, but what surprises me is how nearly seamless, you know, what, you know, he contributed and what I contributed and how well it blends together. And I think, you know, some of that was he'd come up with something and I'd tweak it a little bit and he'd go back and tweak it and I'd tweak it again. So it kind of all homogenized in a good way to read as if one person wrote it, at least to me. But
Well, I think one of the reasons it worked out that way is we have written together scripts and screenplays for many years. And in the case of a screenplay, which is an adaptation of a book, I could be writing something and literally stop in mid-sentence if it was 4:30 in the morning, and I said, that's it, I'm out. And I would give it to him, and he could continue the sentence and continue, not just finishing a sentence, but finishing a thought, finishing, you know, structurally that scene. And we just worked back and forth like that. So when it came to the book, I don't think anyone really appropriated a character. I didn't write John Dillinger. He didn't write Abraham Lincoln. We went back and forth, and it was always the other person's, you know, approval or disapproval or suggestion that, you know, suggested, you know, where to go with it.
You know, and the other thing, of course, everything in today's thriller and suspense writing, everything is always modern. I mean, you know, there's cell phones, there's DNA, there's fingerprints, there's all that kind of fun little thing. But when you're writing about something, you know, back 100 years ago, how are you kind of able to, you know, you have to rein all that in. Is it difficult as an author to be able to rein all of that in and not have to use all the new technology because, you know, basically you're writing about an era that you didn't grow up in and you have to kind of research, you know, what were the people like? How were they dressed? How would they react? You know, and those types of things, because scary back then is no longer scary, I guess, today.
Well, I see what you're saying. I think, you know, good writing is good writing. And if you draw people into a story and give them characters they can care about and put them in situations that are harrowing or you know, romantic or whatever you're trying to achieve, if it's working, it's working. For me, the 1860s and the 1930s, and I think I could speak for Brian too, those are two eras that were favorites of ours in terms of reading about and learning about over the years. Certainly with Brian's background as a film historian and knowing about, you know, 1930s cinema and all of that background played into creating this particular story. And for me, I hate to say it, but I'm one who hates to do research because it's like you go into a library, you sit down, and you say, okay, where do I start? You know, and then once you're into it, right, you don't know where to stop. But for me, it's like I'll have an idea in my head, and I'll say, okay, is the plot, this plot point going to work? I need to find out the things surrounding it. And as far as that time period and what people knew or didn't know, and then I could say yes, it does, or no, it doesn't, and I have to think of something else. But by and large, that was not a big problem because, again, we were both, you know, so well steeped in these two particular eras.
You know, the other thing is when, you know, when you write a book, you always have secondary characters, of course, that, you know, make everything kind of come together. But there's always surprises with the authors, you know, like yourself, you're writing and you had no idea, you know, maybe that Bob had a bigger role than you had anticipated. Which kind of secondary characters do you feel really kind of shaped the book and had that, you know, kind of dynamic that you didn't think they were going to have maybe when you started writing and ended up having a bigger voice in the end?
Well, it sounds a little simplistic to say, but I'd say the politicians and the gangsters all became more, you know, part of the story than we expected it to. Certainly with FDR, when he met with FDR, that continued to grow. And, you know, FDR's reaction to it, you know, propelled the story further and bring in J. Edgar Hoover and bring in Melvin Purvis. And then with the gangsters, once you got into the gang and members of the gang, Babyface Nelson was a very colorful, very violent character, but a great character to write about because we knew what a explosive personality he had, and somebody could say something about his height. One of the reasons we have him hating Lincoln the way he does is because Lincoln was 6'4", and Babyface Nelson was about 5'4". So, you know, he has that chip on his shoulder, and that really is an engine for a lot of interesting dialogue and situations between the characters.
Yeah, I definitely see that when you're, you know, the secondary ones kind of, and when they have to wrap everything kind of together in a nice little bubble, that when you kind of finish it and you kind of look back at the book, you always get those little surprises and you kind of look at each other and you just have to say, like, wow, this kind of ended a little differently than maybe we thought it was going to end.
Well, you know, for me, when I'm writing, I sort of consider myself the ultimate actor because I'm inhabiting each character as I'm writing them. And sometimes characters will, you know, take over and start, you know, dictating where the story's going. And if it's working, I'm flying along on the keyboard. But there are times when I start writing slower and slower, and I realize that something's not working, and then I'll go back to where it's stopped being, you know, a workable situation and rewrite at that point. But to me, secondary characters can really add depth and enrich the story if you don't treat them as complete throwaways. And that's the way I always approach it.
And now, is this something that, you know, is writing together in the future, anything like historical, this and that, is this something that you guys plan on doing more into the future? Was this maybe like a one-time shot? How is that looking?
Well, we, as I said, we did scripts and screenplays before, and this is the first time we tried a fiction book, and
right.
We both had a blast doing it. It was a lot of fun. It was very gratifying. Really enjoyed the final, and I think before we really had the book finished, we were talking about a few other projects that we had. Maybe we made another film 40 years ago we want to make into a film. But We work well together. We have fun. We live 50 miles away. I have my own company with my wife, and Bill is a graphic artist. And so we have very full lives, but kind of in the downtime, free time is when, you know, basically like to write, like to work. And, you know,
yeah.
The more time you spend writing, just, you know, the more gratifying it is.
Yeah, I mean, so you guys going to have solo projects, I take it, throughout, you know, coming up. Do you kind of see that coming in the future? You know, you guys going to kind of do some solo fiction? You going to continue the screenwriting on your separately, too?
Certainly there are going to be books that interest me or, you know, stories that interest me more than Brian. And he'll probably have his things, too, that he's going to be more well-versed in writing than I want, you know, than I want to do. But, you know, we are planning to continue the story with Mr. Lincoln in a rather unique way. That's, of course, going to be predicated upon how well people receive this one.
Yeah, and so speaking of that, with, you know, everything being so instant, you know, like in Facebook and Twitter, and you can get everything right at your fingertips, right when the book releases, people can read it. How has the reaction been? What is like the main thing that you've noticed that people have been talking about?
Well, what I notice is that thus far, knock wood, people really seem to respond to the story in a positive way, you know, almost overwhelmingly. Now, again, we're talking about a small, you know, cross-section. As the word gets out and more people start reading it, we'll probably get more varied opinions, but I'm fairly confident that we've struck a chord with this book that people are going to pick up on.
And when you sit there and you see those instant reactions, are you kind of surprised with maybe the things that they focus on? Because it always enamors me, like when the magazine comes out and we focus on, you know, this author, we focus on this thing. We get emails from people about stuff in the magazine that was like, really, that's what you picked up on? Is that, you know, have you kind of seen that happening?
I think we see some of that. Lincoln has always been a fascinating character, as has John Dillinger, so usually when people respond, it's about those characters. But we do get a lot of people asking us about details in the book, or, you know, they like things that you wouldn't think would be the first things they would think of. But I think the nicest compliment we get is, tell us more, you know, is there another book? We'd like to, you know, see the adventures of Abe continue. And that's about the best compliment the writer can get, when somebody says, keep writing, do something else, show me something else.
And are you guys going to watch the History Channel Bonnie and Clyde kind of miniseries coming out? Because, I mean, that's like right in the same era as your book. I think it's, what, 34 through 37 they kind of did their
well,
their
actually,
run?
They were pretty much gone by 34 as well.
34 was when they were done, okay.
once the FBI, you know, got empowered to, you know, go across state lines and that sort of thing, that era was basically done.
They died May 34, 2 months before Dillinger. And John Dillinger never had a kind word about Bonnie and Clyde. He thought they were ruthless killers. And uh-huh. Dillinger wasn't. He was much, much more deliberate. He was much more cool-headed. And whereas the police would go out and they would go to a motel he was at and shoot it up and hope they would get him and kill innocent people and Dillinger would get away. Dillinger was just very careful. There isn't any proof that he actually ever killed anyone, although he'd be the first to say that, you know, if the situation arose and he had to shoot somebody, he would. It's just, you know, whether you killed him or the intent to kill is the same. But he was a rather cool character, whereas Bonnie and Clyde were, you know, considered, at least in the history books, pretty murderous thugs. They were pretty
punk,
pretty violent. Yeah.
Do you think that the Johnny Depp movie portrayed Dillinger pretty close to the way he was?
This is Brian speaking for myself. I'd say no. I thought it was pretty much fabrication. And certainly not
really
what I took away. Sometimes you read enough about a character that you maybe you don't truly know them, but you think you know them, and you have such a preconceived notion of what you think they're going to be. And I think that happened in our book. We knew what we thought Dillinger would be, and we knew what we thought Lincoln would be, and we worked with those characters.
That movie especially, it was funny because, you know, both Brian and I are fans of the John Milius film from 1973 with Warren Oates, which was, you know, historically inaccurate in lots of different ways. And what was funny to me about the film with Johnny Depp is they had Babyface Nelson dying at the wrong time
right,
in both movies. So
I remember seeing that. That was hilarious. I thought that was kind of funny, too. It was like totally wrong thing.
Yeah, now the one thing I did think was great about the film was the scene at the Biograph where, you know, how they, you know, showed him being shot and that the wounds were accurate and that kind of thing. Overall, it was. I pretty much agree with Brian as far as, you know.
I think one of the problems with that movie, I like Johnny Depp as an actor. I think as an actor, he did a good job. But it's imposing a current sensibility on a time that was the 1930s. And sometimes stylistically, they just don't mesh. I thought a lot of the music just, I think period music works very well in the period films. And sometimes the newer music is just too anachronistic. And it just doesn't feel of that time.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys, we want to thank you so much for coming on. I mean, this has been fascinating. It's one of the greatest eras in, you know, U.S. history, whether or not it was dark or not. It was still a great era, and to write about it is always fascinating to read about. And we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your book, Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number One.
Well, thank you. It was great to be here.
Thank you, John.
All right, you guys have a good day, and we will speak with you guys later.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is authors Bill Walker and Brian Anthony, the book, Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number One. You can go to LincolnPublicEnemy.com for a lot more information to find out about the ins and outs of the book. Like I said, it's one of those great kind of eras in American history. And we know, you know, it might have been dark, but it was still the gangsters, the era, the whole thing. And it's really fascinating to kind of see how, you know, you kind of bring Abe Lincoln up into that and wrap it all around the story. So it was just one of those fascinating reads with great reviews that you should go check out. And again, Christmas is coming around the corner, so you have no excuse. And we will see you guys all on the next Suspense Radio One-on-One. I believe it's next Sunday. Check out the website, suspensemagazine.com. Click on Suspense Radio for a lot more information. Because until then, everybody, thank you and goodbye.